The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. Divorce, custody battles, domestic violence. These cases unfold every day in family courts. But the stories don't end in the courtroom. The courtroom is just the beginning. This is Love, Lust, Law, and I'm your host, Michelle Locke. I've spent 23 years practicing as a divorce attorney and presided over more than 5,000 cases as an associate court judge in Texas over a dedicated family violence court. I'm also the child of divorce, and after a 22-year marriage, I've been through a divorce of my own. When I say I've lived every side of family law, I mean it. Now I'm bringing that experience to the mic so we can unpack the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. Today, I'm joined by Jake Deptula, a seasoned victim advocate and podcaster who just so happens to be my executive producer. He'll be by my side as I break down one of the most high-profile divorces of the early 2000s, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. When they got married in 2000, Brad and Jennifer were Hollywood royalty. They were the couple everyone rooted for, tabloid gold. Their fame only grew. Jennifer was still America's sweetheart on Friends, and Brad was landing blockbuster after blockbuster, from Troy, Ocean's 12, to Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And in May 2004, not long after he started filming that last movie, rumors started flying about Brad's on-set chemistry with Angelina Jolie. Both Brad and Jennifer denied the affair rumors at the time, but almost a year later, in March of 2005, Jennifer filed for divorce. Well, what happened after that? Most of it was kept behind closed doors, and that's intentionally done. But today, I want to open that door just a little. Not to rehash the gossip, but to talk about what it's actually like when two incredibly famous and incredibly wealthy people get divorced. I want to walk you through the legal strategy and what likely happened behind the scenes, not just from an attorney's perspective, but from the human one as well. Because at the end of the day, Brad and Jennifer were two people who thought they'd be together forever. No different than any other couple in love embarking on life as a married couple. But unlike everyday people, they were untangling their lives with the whole world watching. I'll be sharing statements they've made publicly, and along the way, I'll be giving you the same advice I give my clients when the stakes are high and the emotions are even higher. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get into it. Rewinding all the way back to my senior year of high school, 1994. The sign by Ace of Base, and I Swear by All for One, were playing on every radio station, and movie theaters were packed with hits like Lion King and Forrest Gump. And on NBC, a new sitcom called Friends had just premiered. The show followed six friends living in New York City: Rachel, Monica, Phoebe, Joey, Chandler, and Ross, played by Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc, Matthew Perry, and David Schwimmer. From the very beginning, the show was a hit. Audiences connected with all of the characters, but it was Jennifer Aniston's portrayal of Rachel Green that took a life on of its own. Her role was so impactful that her haircut, the Rachel, became a global trend. She wasn't just popular, she was everywhere. That first season changed her entire life and launched her into a different stratosphere of fame. That same year, her manager introduced her to Brad Pitt. He had just starred in Interview with the Vampire and Legends of the Fall, both major films that cemented his status as one of Hollywood's most promising young actors. Jennifer and Brad met, but they were each in relationships and the timing just wasn't right. A few years later, in 1998, they both happened to be single and their managers arranged for another meeting. By then, both of their careers were on fire. Jennifer was still on Friends, which was pulling in around 25 million viewers every week. Brad had become one of the most recognizable actors in the world and had just been named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive. This time, they connected instantly. Jennifer later described the first evening as really easy and really fun, an early glimpse of the chemistry that would soon turn them into one of the most talked about couples in the world. I think Brad and Jennifer knew their relationship would make headlines, the kind that dominate magazine covers, talk shows, and every hot couple roundup for years to come. So at first, they kept things quiet. Jennifer later told Vanity Fair that some of her fondest memories were of that early private chapter. "We had so much fun falling in love," she said. "It was so private. We kept it to ourselves for so long. It was something we were really proud of."
Michelle, can you talk about the pressure that comes with being in a relationship under that kind of spotlight?
Relationships are difficult no matter what. Then you add in the level of fame, where you've got people taking pictures of you every time you come out of a restaurant, anytime you come out of a sporting event. And I really kind of compare it to now Travis and Taylor, because they can't go anywhere without someone following them. Everyone's got a built-in camera on their phone that takes really good pictures. So there's no privacy. They were never left alone. And they're still human beings at the end of the day. When they got married, I don't have any doubt that they thought it was forever. I don't have any doubt that they didn't plan on it ending the way it did. They were madly in love. No one knows what happens behind closed doors. And I can tell you, even when Brad and Jennifer got divorced, they had to go into a system that they didn't control. Like in their regular jobs, they control where they go on the TV shows, the movies, they control the scripts. They know their domain, but they walked into a court domain that neither one of them were familiar with. And I don't care who they are, what they are. I don't care how much money you have. You don't have any of the power when you walk into that courtroom.
Fame also does start to shape or strain what would be private moments.
Oh, absolutely. I think you lose your ability to have real private moments. Think about the dates you've been on. Can you imagine, like, how many restaurants do you go to and you have a really, like, fun time at a restaurant and are laughing and having a glass of wine and just enjoying yourself? But yet, if you're Taylor and Travis or Jennifer and Brad, you've got people snapping pictures or staring and pointing at you the whole time. That's got to be miserable.
There was an era where that was completely seen as intrusion. But I think that the understanding of how social media works now, I think that a lot of celebrities use moments like that to their advantage. I think they've figured out how to work the system and they know how to schedule things appropriately. And this is no secret. Many celebrities over the years have tipped off the paparazzi to where they're at, when they're going to be there. Paparazzi have been around for a long time, but you know, TMZ didn't technically start until 2005. So you're talking about—
Really?
Yeah. When Brad and Jennifer had gotten together, TMZ wasn't a thing, but paparazzi were a thing. And so they would seek out photos for magazines, traditional periodicals, you know what I'm saying? Paper magazines.
It wasn't always a bid for the picture.
It was a higher price tag for those kind of things. There were probably only a handful of couples that would have commanded 5 or 6 figure rates when it comes to these pictures. But also too, you got to remember is that during this time, Jennifer was on TV Weekly. So there was this publicity machine through NBC and through what her managers, her agents, her publicists were trying to devise. And I think that ultimately during that time, anybody she went out with, had coffee with, went shopping with, was part of this system, was part of the obsession that people had with her. Arguably, you could say that she was the friend who had the most attention way before even the celebrity romances took hold.
I remember I was in law school from 1999 to 2002, and I had 2 really good girlfriends in law school. And every Thursday, we would get together to watch Friends. Mm-hmm. And we'd cook. My friend Melissa would make lasagna and some stuffed mushrooms. I'd bring the wine. But every Thursday, we watched Friends for 3 years. It's actually one of my fondest memories of law school, because I hated law school for so many reasons. But one of the good memories really was watching Friends on Thursday nights with lasagna, stuffed mushrooms, and some wine.
It was a bonding moment for so many people of your age and of your era. And
don't just say mine. Don't just say mine.
Of my age and my era. Many people's ages and eras. But I think the thing is there was a commonality and there was sort of something that was connective about that show. And the chemistry between all those characters was remarkable. Like in terms of from a casting standpoint, like how difficult it would be. And then every one of those characters became a celebrity unto themselves. It was literally the purest sense of an ensemble you can get.
It's important, in my opinion, to date someone that's on your own level, mm-hmm. because then they understand where you're going, what you're going through, what has to be done, the reasons. And so I think to some extent, it's smart that someone like Brad and Jennifer were together because they were both on the same level. So there was not some power discrepancy between the two of them, which I think can actually help relationships work.
We've seen other relationships and celebrity relationships where one of the participants or half of the couple are a way bigger star than the other one. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think that regardless of the publicity that you're getting, when you are in the same industry, you are competing for the same sort of attention.
I think Jennifer got the short end of the stick for so many reasons. Maybe not in the settlement, but Brad seemed to come out of it mostly unscathed. By September 1999, Brad and Jennifer decided to go public. They made their red carpet debut as a couple at the Emmy Awards. And from there, the frenzy kicked into high gear. The media latched on, fans became obsessed, and suddenly, they weren't just dating. They were a spectacle. It was America's sweetheart and the sexiest man alive, together. For the press, it couldn't get any better than this. Jennifer later told Vanity Fair that once their relationship went public, it became difficult to reconcile their public image with the reality of how they actually lived. Most nights were spent watching TV, ordering in, or hanging out with friends, not walking red carpets or throwing champagne parties. She said, "We were put on a pedestal, but we were just a couple like anybody else." The media attention only intensified after their beachside wedding in Malibu. On July 29th, 2000, Brad and Jennifer tied the knot in front of about 200 guests, friends, families, and co-stars. The event was extravagant. 50,000 flowers, 4 live bands, a 7-hour reception, and a 13-minute fireworks show. It sounds like a beautiful celebration, the one that we all dream of. It sounds like an event that was nothing but perfect. Everything Hollywood could imagine. But let's pause here, because this is where I need to put on my lawyer hat. There's plenty of speculation about whether Brad or Jennifer signed a prenuptial agreement before they got married. E! Online reported that they didn't, and quoted a friend of Brad saying, "Brad's not like that." But I couldn't find anything from Brad or Jennifer directly confirming it in either way. Now, I will tell you, my thought on it is based on what happened in his divorce with Angelina, is that he did not do a prenup in this particular case because he and Angelina ended up fighting over property and kids and everything else. And that was much more public. Because of that, it would lend me to believe that that statement from that friend that Brad isn't like that, doesn't do prenups, was probably accurate when he and Jennifer tied the knot. And in that divorce, they fought over property. And what really comes to mind is the vineyard that they thought about. But what really struck me was if they had a prenup, those property issues probably would not have gone to a courtroom fight, which makes me think there was no prenup with Brad and Angelina. And then if he didn't do one on that marriage, then he was less likely to do one with his first marriage. So I really think that that quote from his friend is probably accurate. I know some people think that prenup agreements are only done because you know your marriage is going to end. I would caution people who have high assets about not doing one. I don't think they're not romantic. I don't think that's the issue. I think that nowadays in our world with cryptocurrency and we have so many different types of assets that it would be smart to track them and trace them from the beginning of a marriage. And that's not done to try and screw one person out of the other. But I look at prenups as an opportunity to bargain for your best case scenario at the end of the divorce. I mean, really, you can use it to your advantage if you so choose.
When those stakes are so high and you're dealing with people who have 7, 8, 9-figure assets, do you think that these celebrities, when they are getting ready to get married, that their representatives caution them heavily, especially their business managers, their accountants, on not getting a prenup signed?
I would be willing to bet that most of their professional inner circle advised them to get a prenup because they needed to cover their stuff and said, "Highly recommend that you get one. Here are the reasons why. If you don't get one, here are the consequences of you not getting one. And here's how you keep track of your property. And please sign here to acknowledge I've given you this warning." And so I would suspect that happened a lot.
I can't imagine anybody in the circle of these people encouraging them not to get a prenup, other than the couple themselves thinking that we don't want to do something that's going to shed any doubt on our union not being forever.
I agree, but my analysis of it is if you can't have those types of difficult discussions with your partner before you even get married, what in the world's going to happen when you have to have the difficult discussions when you are married? Because I hate to break it, they will come up. But if you can't do it before, then why are you getting married? There needs to be a discussion. And if it's a conscious decision by both parties saying, nope, we're not going to do it. We've been advised. We know why. And you know, they're making the conscious decision, fine. But there should be some kind of, let's talk about what we need to do. In a marriage, you will have to have difficult discussions. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And so you might want to figure out before you get married whether you can even have the difficult discussions with the person you plan on marrying. Mm-hmm. Because let me tell you, how someone handles discussions or disagreements is very much indicative of whether the marriage will work or not. It's not entirely clear what assets Brad and Jennifer brought into the marriage either. But based on what's publicly known, both were financially secure long before the wedding. Each owned property and both had already built successful careers. They entered the marriage with substantial individual assets, an important detail, and one more reason a prenup would have made sense. After getting married, they began acquiring property and building a life together. The house, built in 1934, sat on 1.2 acres and featured 4 bedrooms and more than twice as many bathrooms. Brad and Jennifer invested heavily into renovations. They added heated marble floors in the kitchen, a private screening room, a hand-carved marble bathtub, and wood floors imported from a 200-year-old French chateau for their pub room. One part of the home had floor-to-ceiling windows that opened directly onto the backyard, where there was a pool, shaded lounge chairs, and thick privacy hedges. The outdoor entertaining space was expansive and meticulously designed. It was an absolute showpiece, exactly what you would expect from the couple at the top of their game in Hollywood. Together, they embodied the power couple image. Their home, their careers, their public presence, everything about them attracted attention. Media coverage followed their every move, and fascination only grew. And in 2002, they expanded their partnership professionally by launching Plan B Entertainment. The production company saw early success and quickly became a serious player in the industry. They had multiple films in development, including Troy starring Brad, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Johnny Depp. As their business ventures grew, so did the public interest in their personal lives. In February 2004, Jennifer shared publicly that she was ready to start a family with Brad. She described the timing as right and spoke openly about her desire to become a mother. From the outside, it appeared to be a time of growth and stability for both their relationship, their careers, and their future plans. But just 3 months after Jennifer said she was ready to start a family, tabloids began reporting something else entirely. And in May 2004, stories surfaced that Brad had developed feelings for his on-screen wife while filming Mr. and Mrs. Smith, an action comedy about a married couple who discovered they're both assassins, working for rival agencies, and both have been assigned to kill each other. His co-star was Angelina Jolie, who had just gotten divorced from Billy Bob Thornton. Filming began in January 2004. It paused briefly in late April and then resumed later that summer. In early May, rumors about Brad and Angelina's growing closeness, both on and off the set, dominated headlines. The speculation was everywhere. And whether your spouse is in Hollywood or not, when that kind of rumor starts spreading, it forces a conversation. I always go back to the old adage of, where there is smoke, there is fire.
Michelle, what's your advice to couples navigating serious accusations like this, whether you're in the spotlight or not?
The conversations are always really difficult to have. And that kind of goes back to what you and I talked about earlier, which was even with prenups. I mean, you've got to have the difficult conversations early on. Otherwise, when stuff happens to marriage, just like this, you have to be able to discuss it. And it's never a good conversation. There's never a right time to have the conversation. Because how do you ask someone, hey, I've heard a rumor you're sleeping around? How do you do that? I mean, how do you do that without starting a fight? Or the other option is they can say, I did it. What I really think people should do is just be more honest, because denying the affair when you know there is one is so disrespectful to your spouse. Well, I guess you're disrespecting them by cheating on them anyways. But it's a tough conversation to have. And so I think there has to be some strategizing behind when you're going to confront your significant other about an affair. I think it needs to be done in a manner in which you know you'll be safe, because sometimes those that have affairs react inappropriately when accused of having affairs. And I'm going to tell you all, don't go through the phones. I can't tell you how many fights there are over phones and then the cops get called because there's some physical altercation about grabbing the phone. It happens all the time. And that's why it's really important to strategize when you're going to go talk to your significant other about cheating or even allegations of cheating. The other thing I'll say is don't treat your spouse like they're stupid. When there is a bunch of smoke, there really is fire usually. I mean, it really is. And especially in Hollywood, by the time the rumors get to the media, it's been going on for 6 months.
Michelle, I've worked in Hollywood for over a generation now, okay? Just wanted to clarify that, okay?
I love this generation stuff where it's never going to die between us.
100%. A very inside joke, but...
Very inside joke.
Yeah, but I've seen a lot of showmances. Are you familiar with a showmance is?
When you are in a show, movie, whatever, and you have to have chemistry with that person, that chemistry sometimes carries off screen because you have to make it believable when you're recording it, I'm assuming. I mean, I'm not an actress, but I think that's probably very similar to like doctors who sleep with the nurses or lawyers who sleep with their paralegals. It's because you're in that same vicinity for so long that it just makes it easy.
That's a pretty accurate definition. It's a romance between two stars that lasts only for the run of the show. However, to your point, it can be on camera, it can be off camera. So I've seen a lot of these. Some of them have worked out, some of them have not. The certain intensity during production allows for a couple things. One, you're bonding in a very intimate way with a lot of people, okay? It takes you away from your family. It takes you away from your friends. Depending upon the intensity of the project and depending upon the deadlines, all those kind of things. So very much akin to being on a working vacation in some capacity. Not always the most fun vacation, but a working vacation. So I think that part of the rules that only apply when you're working on set or working on a production are way different than the outside rules. So I think that a lot of people in the industry understand what the pluses and minuses of a showmance. And I'm not even talking about the HR nightmare that can create as well.
See, the lawyer brain in me is going, oh God, then they've got lawsuits for a hostile work environment if it doesn't work out. Because if you've got a married actor or actress that's going and making out with someone else that's not their spouse on the show, can you allege adultery? It's kind of like when you have swingers and a swinging couple, one alleges adultery. I'm like, how can you allege adultery when you're in an open swinging relationship? That's a different discussion. My understanding, and Jake, I'm sure you'll correct me, but like the sex scenes in movies are not fun to film because they're not what anyone thinks they are for so many different reasons. But you're still having to fake that intimacy. That's got to carry over. I mean, everyone's human still.
You're talking about professional actors who are in situations where up until recently, there weren't people on set that were mandated called intimacy coordinators. It happened around the ground zero of Me Too and Time's Up, making sure that people feel very comfortable and safe in these work environments. Intimacy coordinators don't necessarily have any sort of jurisdiction over a showmance, but it's more about how professionally you deal with things like nudity on set or graphic sexual scenes. These are two leads of a major motion picture as well. Very few people can understand what they're going through in the world in terms of the pressure.
I get it. That's why for me to not date a lawyer is odd or not someone that doesn't know the court system, because how do you come home and explain how your day was?
The same intimacy that grows within the sector that you're in could also be complications because you're trying to solve each other's problems because you're both in the same sector, or you have too many commonalities, or you're actually doing things to sort of, let's say, numb or water down the intimacy in the relationship because you're so concentrated on the commonalities of your careers. I think that happens as well too. I think that you can be overwhelmed by that.
It can be too much of the same because then it's like, is there anything else we can talk about? It's a double-edged sword. I mean, it's what draws you at first, and after a while, it gets old. Jennifer's friend, Courtney Cox, later told Vanity Fair that Jennifer and Brad did talk about the rumors. Brad was honest. He told Jennifer he had developed feelings for Angelina. He admitted the attraction had been building for some time, but he also insisted that nothing physical had occurred. Close friends also echoed that. They believe there hadn't been a physical affair, but they also said that Brad had checked out of the marriage around the time that Mr. and Mrs. Smith began filming in January 2004. Jennifer later confirmed that timeline. She described that period as incredibly difficult. At the same time production on Smith was getting underway, she had just wrapped her final episode of Friends, an emotional milestone 10 years in the making. When she needed the support, Brad wasn't there. He didn't even attend the final taping. Despite all of that, Jennifer and Brad still attended the Troy premiere together 1 week after the rumors of Brad's feelings for Angelina began. They were hoping to calm the tabloids, and for a while, it worked. But in August, filming resumed on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, first in Los Angeles and later in Italy. Paparazzi photos captured Brad and Angelina looking affectionate, and the headlines came roaring back. Filmmakers said the images were taken on the set and showed them in character. But at that point, most of the public had made up their minds. For the next 5 months, there was little public information about what was happening behind the scenes. According to friends close to the couple, Jennifer told Brad she was willing to work things out, but he'd already made the decision to move on. And then on January 7th, 2005, Brad and Jennifer released a joint statement announcing their separation. They stated, "We would like to announce that after 7 years together, we have decided to formally separate. For those who follow these sorts of things, we would like to explain that our separation is not the result of any of the speculation reported by tabloid media. This decision is a result of much thoughtful consideration. We happily remain committed and caring friends with great love and admiration for one another. We ask in advance for your kindness and sensitivity in the coming months."
Michelle, you've been to a dinner party where it's obvious the couple has been fighting before you got there, right?
It's so awkward, but everyone pretends like the elephant in the room isn't there. I can't even imagine how difficult going to that Troy premiere must have been for Jennifer for a couple of reasons. While I had just made the headlines, right, about his feelings for Angelina, I would be willing to bet that Jennifer knew about it a while back. She didn't find out the week before the Troy premiere. She'd probably been living with it for a while. And as we know now, was undergoing fertility treatments at least probably the year before. And so she has to go to a premiere for a movie her husband's in, and she's getting ready to look picture perfect, and now we call it like Instagram perfect. And she has to go stand by him and smile. If that isn't the biggest testimony to her acting skills, I don't know what else is, because if you've ever been to someone's house, when it's obvious the couple's had a fight before you get there, you can't miss it. Like, you can feel the tension in the room. And they went and put on a facade at the Troy premiere that everything was fine. I think most people didn't believe it, but still, they put on this front. And I think it probably was harder for Jennifer than Brad, because Brad already had feelings for someone else. And so for him, it's like he just went through the motions. But for her, she had just had her heart ripped out. That's got to be difficult. Brad and Jennifer asked for kindness and privacy, and they got the exact opposite. Tabloid coverage exploded after their separation, and so did the rumors. Some of the most hurtful headlines placed the blame for the marriage ending on Jennifer. There was constant speculation that she didn't want to have children, that she chose her career over starting a family. Other rumors claimed she couldn't get pregnant. Either way, the public was told that she was the reason Brad was leaving. And really, because the cause is always a successful woman, right? I mean, that's always the problem. And we need to come back to that, Jake, because I'm actually really, when I finished reading this, was really angry, because I do think they blamed it on the career woman as opposed to the man who went and found someone else with an emotional connection while he was married to her. She really got blamed for, well, she couldn't produce a kid and she was working, so she's not good as a woman. It's bullshit.
To your point, there was a combination at the time of coverage about Jen's failings. Simultaneously, it was also Angelina stealing Jen's man. So Brad really didn't get much scathing.
I know, which I don't understand. But then Jennifer issues the statement, right? They do the joint statement. And I got to tell you, when I read that joint statement, I'm like, well, that's to save his ass.
I remember at the time, there wasn't much coverage about his misdeeds. It was literally Jen losing a man because she couldn't keep him, and Angelina stealing a man.
She lost a man because she was a career woman and couldn't have kids. The era hasn't changed. I know, as a woman that's 48, one of the big concerns, I think the joke I always tell, because someone asked me, well, are you getting back in the dating game? And I was like, no. And my joke was, I said, I have more of a chance of getting struck by lightning than I do of finding a good man. And then you get punished because you're intelligent, independent, and career oriented. So weird. It's like a double-edged sword. You're an attractive woman, and, you know, not bad looking and smart. Men like that. But then they get that and they're like, well, this sucks because guess what? I'm smart, intelligent, independent, and a career person. I'm also a good mom, but that's a different story.
I've heard this in multiple conversations with many people I've spoken to, is that it's generalization, but it rings true to the people I've talked to in some ways, is that women try to change men. Men try to control women.
Yep.
And if you really break it down to that, I think that it's a very sad state of affairs when someone like this gets drugged through the media and everyone says, well, that's what they signed on for. But did they really sign on for this kind of abuse and scrutiny in the media?
No one signs up for it. She signed up for love. She signed up for a lifetime with a person and it didn't work. And then the media makes it that much more difficult for her. And I think we'll talk about in a little bit how she stop reading the tabloids. That's what I would have done. I'd have stayed holed up in some beach house in some far off place where there's no media. Wouldn't have watched any media because, you know, I had this conversation with my stepsister yesterday. Is you can't care what people say about you. You can't live your life based on what people say about you. And that's in Hollywood, that's what they end up having to do sometimes. I mean, that's why they issued a joint statement. I'm sure at some point, Jennifer would like to say, Brad, I can't stand you. I can't believe you did this to me. You shredded my heart. But you can't do that. You've got to play for the media. So save him and save her. And they had a production company at the time that made money. So she can't trash him because it's a business interest. Also, an important part of that's why you marry people on your same standing so that everyone has the same amount to lose. Otherwise, if there's a disparity in power and someone has nothing to lose, they will come after you and do everything they can to destroy you.
When Jennifer and Brad got together, you mentioned this earlier, is that it was storybook. It was many people rooting for them, right?
Yep.
But when Brad and Angelina got together, it was primarily the opposite. I don't think people wanted it to work. I think they saw it as the destruction of Brad and Jen's relationship, and they saw Angelina as a homewrecker in that capacity. I don't know anyone who was feeling that this is something that is destined for the stars because everyone was already on that train. And I also think this too, is that as popular and as successful and as famous as Jen and Brad were when they first got together, it was far different by the time that Angelina and Brad got together because there was already a kickoff of controversy. Yep. Where Jen and Brad had both been out of relationships, were both very single and got together. So I think that the dynamics are very different when it comes to both those relationships.
Jennifer later spoke to Allure about how damaging the narrative was. She said it wasn't true. The end of her marriage had nothing to do with her ability or inability to start a family, and that anyone saying otherwise was lying. What wasn't a lie was that she had been struggling with infertility. In her words, I was trying to get pregnant. It was a challenging road for me. All the years and years and years of speculation. It was really hard. I was going through IVF, drinking Chinese teas, you name it. I was throwing everything at it. Having the most personal parts of her life reduced to tabloid headlines was painful enough. But on top of that, she couldn't even leave her house without being swarmed by paparazzi. Her entire life was under a microscope. To protect her peace, Jennifer stopped reading tabloids. She moved into a quiet bungalow in Malibu and hired 24/7 security and rarely left the house. Brad, meanwhile, was also navigating the media frenzy, but he wasn't exactly retreating from the spotlight. He was often seen in public with Angelina Jolie. Although they denied being in a relationship, the optics told a different story. They were photographed together frequently on vacation with her children and in settings that didn't look coincidental. Whatever they weren't hiding it. This happens in divorce a fair amount because divorces can drag on for, some can drag on for years. Think about how long Angelina and Brad's divorce has lasted, and they were only married for 2 years. Divorces can last a long time. And so clients will quite often, well, can I date? And I'm like, well, don't do it publicly, number one, especially if it's early on in the divorce. If it's a little bit later on in the divorce, it's a little bit different of an analysis. But if the allegation is the person you're with is the reason you're getting divorced, let's not get caught in public with looking like the happy family when I'm in the middle of a divorce with my ex-wife, who is America's sweetheart. There would be a very tense phone call if Brad was my client and I'd seen some of these pictures. And there probably would have been some expletives in the phone conversation going, what are you doing? You're not helping yourself any. Knock it out. Do whatever you want, but do it behind closed doors so that we don't see it. And make sure you're not spending your money on it. So for me, I look at it from a different perspective of not the morality of it. It's like, you're not helping yourself get divorced any quicker.
No. No, you're right about that. The same advisors that may have been frustrated by Brad and Jen's inability to get a prenup may be the same publicist who advised Brad not to be seen in public too often with Angelina. Who knows?
Right. But, you know, then I think Brad did exactly what he did with the prenup advice and said, here, hold my beer.
Well, I mean, that to be fair,
really,
that's what I'm talking about. It's like where certain celebrities were like, I'm just going to do what I want to do and let everyone deal with it. And this, remember, this is the time before social media too. There wasn't the power of the people to speculate, to create TikTok videos, to do YouTube deep dives into celebrity culture, relationships, potential infidelity. It's a heavier perspective now, but celebrities, I think, can use media to their advantage in a way where they couldn't before, because now they can really just talk straight from their social media channels and they don't have to have it filtered through publicists, filtered through magazines, filtered through television. However, that's also a double-edged sword, as we've seen people do these apology videos often.
Right, because they didn't follow their publicist or their lawyer's advice.
And they turn out pretty damn drastic.
When clients are listening to your lawyer, I'm like, why are you paying me for legal advice and then just to ignore it? I mean, it's like you're burning money, but okay, burn it. I mean, it just makes no sense. Like, I'm not telling you this stuff because I'm trying to harm you. I'm not telling you this stuff to make you angry. I'm telling you this stuff because I've been in the courts for 23 years. I've been litigating cases. And so I can tell you what the range of possibilities is likely to be. Occasionally, there's out of left field, but the optics are everything. And you want to go into court with as clean of hands as possible when you're going in front of a judge and asking them to grant you a divorce and grant you custody or grant you possession or access. But you want to go with clean hands. And if you're going out there doing stuff like that, you're not going into court with clean hands. And that's, for me, it's the, you're making my job harder. You're making your divorce more difficult. Why? Just do it behind closed doors for now. One of my closing arguments a couple months ago, and my client wasn't the bad guy. Like, he had done all the right things. There was no affair. I mean, no affair, nothing. And I apologized for him. I said, we're sorry you're in this position. It's not always hard ass in court. And I think that's what people forget. People think in court that you're supposed to be like just driving the nail home every single time. And that's not always the approach. Your approach really is case specific. And sometimes it's a, I'm sorry, approach. On March 25th, 2005, Jennifer filed for divorce from Brad in Los Angeles Superior Court. In her filing, she cited irreconcilable differences.
Michelle, can you walk us through what irreconcilable differences actually mean in legal terms?
It means you all just can't get along anymore and you both want to end your marriage. It's the no fault grounds, because there's also fault grounds for like affairs and divorce. Quite often in cases where we have potentials of affairs or potentials for other fault grounds for divorce. Like, some states have habitual drunkenness as a grounds for divorce. And so the fault grounds vary state to state. But what I do on cases is, if there are what I know to be fault grounds, but we haven't pled them yet, or we haven't asked for divorce on those grounds yet, I will usually put in my pleadings, and petitioner reserves the right to amend to add additional grounds for divorce. And when I put that in there, it is almost always an indication to the opposing counsel that we're being nice for right now. But if it gets ugly, we reserve the right to amend. Now, technically, at least in Texas, I'm not required to say we reserve the right to amend. You can amend your petition for divorce as many times as you want to up until right before trial. Some counties in Texas, it's 2 weeks before trial. Some, it's a week before trial. It's just depending on the rules. So you don't need to put the language in of, we reserve the right to amend to add additional grounds for divorce. But that is occasionally what lawyers will do to indicate to the opposing side there's a whole lot more and we're being nice right now. We want to break down their divorce from a legal standpoint, starting with the fact that California is a no-fault state, so they have divorces granted on irreconcilable differences, which means you all just can't get along. California also has fault grounds for divorce, but they also have the, hey, judge, we just can't get along anymore. Not every state is a no-fault divorce state, or not every state has no-fault grounds, but basically the ones that do, it just says, we don't get along anymore, so we need a divorce. Like some states, the no-fault grounds kick in a time frame. Like if you have no-fault grounds for divorce, like I know in South Carolina, if you have no-fault grounds for divorce, you have to have a year of separation before you can file divorce on no-fault grounds. And then if you've got fault grounds in just South Carolina, for example, you can get divorced quicker. So the fault grounds can also dictate how long your divorce may or may not take. In California, property division generally follows a 50-50 model, unless there's a prenup or fault grounds for the divorce. The same time Brad and Jennifer were going through their divorce, the divorce rate in 2005 was 3.6 divorces per 1,000 people, which is actually the lowest rate since 1970. It's unclear exactly how much Jennifer and Brad earned during their 5 years of marriage, but Forbes estimated Brad's net worth to be about $100 million, with Jennifer close behind at $75 million. Their joint assets included their 12,000-square-foot home in Beverly Hills, which sold for $32 million about 5 years ago, and Plan B, the production company they launched together. Both the house and the company were considered shared property, and both had to be divided. Each of them still owns homes in the Hollywood Hills, and those are properties they brought into the marriage. As the properties were purchased prior to marriage, they were considered a separate property of each of them and could not be divided by the court. And when you're looking at divorces and the property in divorces, you absolutely have to make an analysis over what was done and purchased prior to marriage and what was done after marriage. And that's why it's so important to keep records of the balances of all your accounts, all your mortgage balances, all of your investment accounts, to have those balance statements and those sheets of information before your marriage saved. Because if the divorce even comes down to 20 years later and you still have the documents, you've just made your position in court that much stronger. I can't tell you how many cases I've had. We've got long-term marriages and it's almost impossible, other than an educated guess, to figure out what the values were prior to marriage, which makes it difficult to prove separate property. One detail that made their case even more unique is how they chose to handle it. Jennifer and Brad didn't go through a traditional courtroom process. Instead, they hired a private judge to oversee the process. I will tell you, that may have been more of a unique situation back when they were divorced in 2005. But I have to tell you all, I think private judges are used much more often by high net worth individuals, and that's done for a variety of reasons. So at least in Texas, when you hire a private judge is used to be a former judge, typically they're retired, and they do private judging after retirement. And so they get paid an hourly rate to preside over a case. The beauty of hiring a private judge is a couple things. One, you can expedite your divorce. It is much of an easier process to get in front of a judge that you're paying to sit and listen to your case, as opposed to a judge who has a bunch of other cases on their docket. Oftentimes, courts will have 8, 9, 10 cases set on their docket to start at 9 o'clock in the morning. And we all know going down to the courthouse, we're not getting reached. And so a lot of times people will waste time and money having to go down to wait around for the courts, and they don't get any problems solved. Private judges avoid that. You can handle all the discovery disputes. They can handle basically anything you assign to them to handle. Another benefit of having a private judge would be the confidentiality of it. If you are paying someone to handle the case, it stays out of the courtroom. And the courtroom is the public domain. Basically, anyone can go sit in a courtroom anywhere in this country and go watch the cases. There are a few exceptions, but as a general rule, people can go watch. Look at the Diddy trial. I mean, it's full every single day with people watching because they are public courtrooms. And Brad and Jennifer decided they didn't want their divorce to be public, which was the complete opposite of what happened with Brad with Angelina. And he kept it behind closed doors, which for them allowed them to work out a reasonable solution to their case without the pressures from outside forces, particularly the public and media. In April, just 1 month after Jennifer filed for divorce, Brad was photographed on vacation with Angelina and her son. They were on a beach, and the photos looked like a family portrait. Even though Brad and Angelina continued to deny they were together, the public wasn't buying it. And over the next few months, the photos kept coming in. It became increasingly clear that no matter what statements were being made, Brad and Angelina were a couple. I go back to what I said in court. I can't tell you how many times. If it walks like a duck, looks like a duck, and talks like a duck, it's a duck, y'all. And in September, Jennifer sat down with Vanity Fair's Leslie Bennett and opened up about the divorce for the first time. She said she believed the marriage ended not because of Angelina, but because she and Brad had changed. They had grown into two very different people. Jennifer said she didn't regret marrying Brad, but she did have other regrets. "There's a lot I would probably do differently," she said. "I'd take more vacations, getting away from work, enjoying each other in different environments. But there was always something preventing it. Either he was working or I was." She acknowledged some deeper lessons too. "I wouldn't give over so much of myself, which I did at times," she said. "It was that thing about being a nurturer. I love taking care of people, and I definitely put his needs before mine sometimes. It's seamless. Somewhere along the way, you sort of lose yourself. You don't know when it happens. It's such an insidious thing. You don't really see where it started or where you ended. And there's no one to blame but yourself. I've always been that way in relationships, even with my mom. It's not the healthiest. I feel like I've broken the pattern now. I'll never let myself down like that again. I feel my sense of self is being strengthened because of it." You know, here, can I tell you, I'm reading this thing and I just want to fucking cry because I fucking lost myself.
Michelle, I know. This really hits home. I mean, this year, when I just read this, I'm like, holy shit.
It's fucking like I'm reading my life.
Take your moments. We're here. Michelle, as both the divorce attorney and someone who's actually lived through this yourself, what stands out to you and what Jennifer has shared so far?
This one was a hard one for me because so much of it I identify with and I know my clients identify with. And a couple of lines made me, of her quotes, really, I had to take a minute because she couldn't be more accurate. And it also conveys to me how much she lost herself in that marriage. Yeah. And one of the lines was, "I'll never let myself down like that again." And I can't tell you, and this applies to men and women that end up in relationships that don't go well, is you come out of it thinking and wanting to never let yourself down like that again. And hopefully you can avoid it. But the problem is when you're in love, you let everything go. And you lose who you are and you all become a unit. And that really, you lose your sense of self. It's awful. And it makes me dislike Brad a whole lot. But then on the flip side, when we get to Angelina's case, I like Brad.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I always go back to when people are talking about getting divorced and how it should be handled. They always say, well, my brother's cousin's uncle's nephew went through a divorce and this is what happened. Divorce is so fact-specific. And when I say fact-specific, it's the smallest detail between a divorce. And they could be identical on every ground except for one. And that small fact could change everything. And that's why in some divorces, and I do think that Brad came out of this one unscathed. And I think Jennifer had her heart broken.
Yeah.
And I think on the flip side, when he divorced Angelina, he was the one left shredded. During her Vanity Fair interview, Jennifer also opened up about Brad and Angelina. She said that the joint statement she and Brad released at the time of their separation, the one denying any affair, was accurate, at least based on what she knew then. Jennifer admitted she didn't know exactly what happened between Brad and Angelina. "I just don't know what happened," she said. "There's a lot I don't understand, a lot I don't know. And probably will never know, really. So I choose to take away with me as much integrity and dignity and respect for what that relationship was as I can. I feel as if I'm trying to scrounge around and pick up the pieces in the midst of this media circus." When asked whether she believed Brad's claims that he hadn't cheated before the separation, Jennifer responded with, "I choose to believe my husband. At this point, I wouldn't be surprised by anything, but I'd much rather choose to believe him." She also admitted the photos of Brad and Angelina at a resort with her son, taken just 1 month after she filed for divorce, were painful to see. She said, I would be a robot if I said I didn't feel moments of anger, of hurt, and of embarrassment. Still, even in that hurt, Jennifer chose not to speak poorly about Brad in public. I'm not interested in taking public pot shots, she said. It's not my concern anymore. What happened to him after the separation, it's his life now. I've made a conscious effort not to add to the toxicity of the situation. What a grown-up. What a grown-up. There's a mature, intelligent woman.
Michelle, you've seen firsthand how toxic divorces can become and how quickly they can escalate. What advice do you give to clients who are dealing with a high conflict or retaliatory partner during divorce?
Oh, unfortunately, I handle a fair amount of high conflict, what we call high conflict divorces. And they usually involve kids, almost always. There are some that are contested when it comes to assets, but quite often the really toxic divorces involve children. And when I have clients going through toxic divorces, there's a couple pieces of advice. One is you have to pick your battles. Not everything can be a battle. You also have to be smart about the battles you choose. Because if the person on the other end is the one that's ramping things up, that's making it more toxic, and you know that person because you're with them for however many years, you know what their buttons are. And try to avoid pushing those buttons or setting off those buttons. And that doesn't mean you cave in your positions. That's not what it means. It means you figure out the best strategy to avoid or minimize the toxicity, because when it gets ugly, divorce is already difficult. It really is. It's emotionally draining. You worry, you dream about it, you wake up thinking about it, you're consumed by it. That's why so many people have work performance issues during a divorce. So the advice really is pick the battles. I also will tell clients they should probably find some mental health support, because it's important to have someone to talk to. A lot of times, some of my advice to clients relates to more like lawyer therapy as to legal advice. It's how to manage the divorce and get through it in one piece. And so going to seek a mental health therapy is a good idea when you're in a toxic divorce. Have a good group of friends that are supporting you through it, because there are days where you just want to give up and throw in the towel and say, fine, here, take it all. And that will never benefit you. I know that there are people that get through that divorce and it's so toxic where they're just like, take whatever you want, I'm just out. And that happens. You just walk away from it all, including your house. Jennifer also talked about how difficult it was to go through a divorce with the entire world watching. I'm a human being having a human experience in front of the world, she said. I wish it weren't in front of the world. I try really hard to rise above it. She leaned on her support system. Friends came over to keep her company. And while there were moments of loneliness, she also found some peace in being alone. There's no question it takes getting used to. I'm a partnership person. And if something happens, your instinct is to share it. But you're no longer part of a couple. I definitely miss that. It's sort of like Bambi, like you're trying to learn how to walk. You're a little awkward. You stumble a little bit. The things you would do with your partner, you don't do. It's uncharted territory. But I think it's good for me to be a solo person right now. You're forced to rediscover yourself and take it to another level. If you can find a way to see the glass half full, these are the moments when you learn the most. I've had to reintroduce myself to myself in a way that's different. She also didn't shy away from naming the hard parts. Am I lonely? Yes. Am I upset? Yes. Am I confused? Yes. Do I have my days where I've thrown a little pity party for myself? Absolutely. But I also am doing really well. I've got an unbelievable support team and I'm a tough cookie. I believe in therapy. I think it's an incredible tool in educating the self on the self. I feel very strong. I'm really proud of how I've conducted myself. She also reflected on everything she's been through, no matter how painful, had shaped her in a way she wouldn't undo. I wouldn't change any of it because I really love who I am and am continuing to become, because it's all in the past. This doesn't kill you. You move on. You can't let the devastation of a divorce take over and win. Let it make you this bitter, closed off, angry, skeptical person. Then you're just falling victim to it. You don't want to shut your heart down. You don't want to feel that when a marriage ends, your life is over. You can survive anything. In October 2005, Brad and Jennifer's divorce was finalized. Because the proceedings were handled privately, very few details are publicly known. but here's what's been reported. Even though she could have asked for more, Jennifer settled the divorce without taking half of Brad's earnings. She was awarded their shared home, along with a minor stake in their production company, Plan B. Brad retained the majority share. The house was eventually put up for sale and later sold. Brad also sold his stake in Plan B in the year that followed. Just a few months later, in January 2006, Angelina officially confirmed her relationship with Brad by announcing her pregnancy. Around the same time, Brad began the legal process of adopting her two children, Maddox and Zahara, who would both take the last name Jolie Pitt. From there, Brad and Angelina became Hollywood's new power couple. Their relationship dominated headlines for years, and public attention quickly shifted. It was as if people forgot or chose to forget how the relationship had started. Part of that may have been Jennifer's grace. She consistently told the press that she was happy for Brad and that they remained friends. And if she wasn't bitter, the public had little room to be. Jennifer was dating, working, and from all appearances, genuinely happy. Both Brad and Jennifer moved on with their lives. And in 2014, Brad and Angelina married after nearly a decade together, but their marriage only lasted 2 years, and their divorce would be far more complicated than Brad and Jennifer's had been. We'll get to that story in the next episode. Meanwhile, in 2015, Jennifer married actor Justin Theroux in a surprise ceremony. They later divorced in 2018. When that separation was announced, Jennifer's publicist released a statement saying, "This decision was mutual and lovingly made at the end of last year. We are two best friends who have decided to part ways as a couple, but look forward to continuing our cherished friendship." And by all accounts, that friendship has continued. Jennifer remains on good terms with both Justin and Brad. The reason we're ending this episode here is simple. Most of the divorces we talk about on this podcast don't end this way. They're not amicable. They don't leave people whole. But it's important to show that divorce doesn't always mean destruction. Jennifer later told Elle that she still viewed both of her marriages as successful. "My marriages, they've been very successful, in my personal opinion. And when they came to an end, it was a choice that was made because we chose to be happy. And sometimes happiness doesn't exist within that arrangement anymore."
Michelle, what does Jennifer's perspective teach us about what it means to have a successful divorce?
I have to really give kudos to Jennifer. I really do. Out of all the ways you can get divorced, she did it the right way. She didn't get ugly. She didn't get nasty. But she could have run him through the mill. I mean, she really could have, and she didn't. That's a testament to who she is as a person and makes me admire her for that choice, because it is not always so easy to take the high road. Sometimes you want your pound of flesh. Sometimes you need that pound of flesh to make you feel whole. And so she didn't. If the relationship started before they got divorced, she probably deserved a pound of flesh out of them. But her decision was something else. So many people can learn from it, because that is one of the ways to get divorced. Now, the other way is what Brad and Angelina did. I don't know. I wouldn't recommend that. But if you want to move forward in life and try and find your own happiness, then doing it Jennifer's way is a really good way of doing it. Because the one thing she said was that I think is accurate, is that marriages end because sometimes people change. And people change for a variety of reasons. And that is okay, because when marriage and the institution of marriage was created long, long, long time ago, life expectancy wasn't that long, right? It's not the same life expectancy we have now. And people change. Like, I know I'm not the same person that I was when I met my ex-husband when I was 23. I'm not the same person. I'm now 48 and I'm not the same person. And we didn't have the same interests anymore. We had lots of other issues, but people change. And unless you consistently work at changing and growing with that person, your marriage isn't going to work. And I think that's what happened to Brad and Jennifer, is they both changed. And so it couldn't work anymore. And that's not a bad thing, y'all. That is part of life. And I think she is right, because it was a choice was made and they chose to be happy. And sometimes being happy means you're not with that person anymore. And that's okay. And as we all know, change is scary. That being said, I think change is also an opportunity to reframe what you think And I know, like, my stepdad always told me, he's like, you never regret the decisions you make in your life. You just learn from them. And I think Jennifer did it that way. She learned from her marriages and divorces. And so I think it's important when you get divorced to reframe it, not as a failure, but take away the good parts that were good parts, and then the bad parts you learn from so that you can avoid that in the future if possible. And that positive outlook, I think that's a positive outlook, can really help you move forward. It's, you know, kind of why I talk about divorce parties now and having a divorce party post your divorce being finalized, because it helps you close that chapter and move on. Oftentimes in marriages, you don't get the I'm sorry, you don't get the you're right, I'm wrong for me opposing side. You simply don't get the closure that you want. And sometimes in life, it's important to create your own closure and figure out how to move on for the next portion of your life. I think Jennifer's done it well. I admire how she handled it. Now that we've discussed the facts surrounding Brad and Jennifer's divorce, I want to share how I would have handled each side to this divorce. And I want to start with Jennifer. To me, in this case, Jennifer had basically the majority of the cards in her hand because of the public perception of what was going on with Brad and Angelina. As a result, I think she had the leverage to settle for more favorable terms on her part of it in order to protect Brad's image. A courtroom is a public domain, period. Public domain that's not run by the court, can't be closed off by the courts, is a public domain. That's how we're able to see all of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard's trial, because courtrooms are public. And the last thing that Brad would want is his divorce to Jennifer being in the public spectrum. And so Jennifer's big advantage was, okay, you want to make this private? You want to hire a private judge? You want to keep this out of the tabloids, out of the public courtroom? Then you're going to have to pay me for that. And so if I was representing Jennifer, I would not have agreed to any kind of confidentiality, sealing of the file, et cetera, unless there was some monetary benefit to my client to do so. Part of it would have been also the client's desires, because the client probably would have said, I really want this to be private. And I think, you know, based on Jennifer's history in particular, she does keep things quiet. But it's worth some money to her, and it's worth some settlement terms for her. And so I think Jennifer held the cards when it came to advantage in settling that case. And I think it settled relatively quickly as far as Hollywood divorces go. And I think it's because they kept it private, they kept it confidential, and they had a private judge. And so one of the benefits of having a private judge is you can move the case along a lot quicker than you could if you were actually in the regular courtrooms, because then you're subject to every other case being heard as well. From Brad's perspective, if I was representing Brad, I would probably tell him, you need to pay her to go away and to keep it quiet, because his career, he'll make back the money. And, you know, and I do tell clients quite often, especially the clients that make good money for a living, is you will earn the money back and you can't buy back peace or time. And so sometimes the giving of more money than you would normally do may be the best way to handle a situation so you can get out of it quickly, quietly, and move on with your life, because you're going to make your own money again, especially Brad in that particular case, and especially when our production company was making money at the time. He wanted to get out and get out quickly, and there's a price to pay to do that. There's also the analysis of separate, I mean, you do tracing, and they'd have to hire experts to do what's separate property and what's community property and reimbursement claims. And there's so much more to it. But if you come down to the brass tacks, Jennifer had the advantage and Brad was a little bit of, he needed to pay her to go away. When you are a public persona, and this applies to politicians, it applies to actors, it applies to anyone that is in the public spotlight for whatever reason, and optics are everything. I mean, think about when we had the really strong cancel culture, and I don't think it's as strong as it was back then, but it was, you did one wrong thing and you were completely canceled. And that would have been no different if this had been a public proceeding and Jennifer had put out all the information or evidence she had with regards to Brad's infidelity, if there was. And, you know, statements that people make in private conversations between the spouses is usually admissible in court. I can't tell you how many times I've been in court in Texas where I asked the witness, well, what did he tell you, he being the spouse, or what did she tell you, her being the spouse? And all of those statements come in. And so the private conversations between Jennifer and Brad during this time could have come into the public foray, and that probably would not have been very good for Brad. We have trials now that half the trials are text messages, and that's just what happens. And that's why I always warn people, be careful what you put in writing, because it's Exhibit A. It doesn't matter if it's a Facebook post, doesn't matter if it's a WhatsApp chat. Those messages can all come in. Y'all, even voicemails have come into evidence. That's one of the other issues, is this went to a public forum, then stuff gets published publicly in the permanent public record that these people won't want. And I think that's the real problem, and that's why Brad really probably had to pay. I don't know what he did, but I would guess probably paid more than he would have to keep everything quiet. My final thoughts after recording this particular episode: there's a right way to do divorce and a wrong way to do divorce. And if kids are involved, there is for sure a good way or bad way to do it. Life is what we make of it. And life is a journey, right? There's going to be ups, there's going to be downs. There are going to be good times, there's going to be bad times. There's going to be times where you don't think that you can keep going for a variety of reasons, including a bad marriage. Every day you wake up is a new day that you get to make however you want to make it. And it's your job to get up every single day and keep putting that one foot in front of the other and making your journey the story you want it to be. To not give away your power to someone who you divorced, to keep your power and keep your strength so that you make your journey in life the most amazing journey there is, despite the ups and downs. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. Don't worry, I'll be back with a new episode. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. Love, Lust, Law is hosted by me, Michelle Locke. Jake Deptula is executive producer. Haley Gray is producer, writer, and researcher. Jared Landis is the sound editor and mixer. Want to reach out to me? You sure can. You can email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Want to find out what I'm up to? You also can follow me on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, for that.